You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Jay Wiener is a longtime Twin Cities sports writer. He is the author of Stadium Games, 50 Years of Big League Greed, and Bush League Boondoggles. In 2008, he changed tact a little bit and reported on the U.S. Senate recount and election contest for MinPost.com, a Minneapolis-St. Paul news website. For his coverage of this, he received Minnesota's prestigious Frank Premack Public Affairs Journalism Award. He's here today to talk about his new book, This Is Not Florida, recently published by the University of Minnesota Press. Please join me in welcoming Jay Wiener.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks to all of my friends and old friends for coming to the University of Minnesota Bookstore. Thanks for them hosting it, and thanks to C-SPAN for being here. It's kind of an honor, so here I go. As you all know, we're on the verge of another election, and one in which at least one and maybe more recounts are likely to occur, from Chicago to Las Vegas, from Michigan to Washington State. I was just in Seattle on Monday, and people are gearing up for their second big recount in about 6 years. And I'll talk about the 2004 recount between Christine Gregoire and Dino Rossi later. Rossi is also a candidate this year. I believe that the lawyers and the campaign managers and the data collectors from any race that's too close to call this year can learn much from what did and did not happen here during what's the longest, largest, and most expensive recount in American history, namely the Al Franken Norm Coleman recount of 2008-2009. 35 weeks, 2.9 million votes, $20 million just spent on the recount alone, another $40 million on the campaign, so a total of $60 million to become the 60th senator. You know, it's often been casually said, and as I've been doing these book promotional tours, everyone always asks, wasn't Franken outlawyered? That's sort of the way that people talk about it. And he did have a band of barristers, is what I call them. They're led by Mark Elias and Chris Sauter from Washington, D.C., and Kevin Hamilton from Seattle, and David Lillehug and Charlie Nowlin are here from the Twin Cities. And Coleman had his own gaggle of lawyers, most of whom were Minnesota-based, except for the well-known election law expert Ben Ginsburg, who served as Coleman's spokesman during the election contest, and he, of course, had been George Bush's main spokesperson during the 2000 Florida recount. That was a victory for Ben Ginsburg. 2008 was not. But I think to broadly attribute the Franken victory to mere lawyering negates some key other factors in his win. One was early and overall preparing for it. Two was data collection and analysis of the data that he collected. Three was fundraising. And four was rapid response to events that occurred. The New Yorker, I got lucky last week, had a brief review of my book, and they wrote, he wrote, she wrote, the side that wanted it more won, and that was the similarity between the Minnesota recount and the Florida recount. But I also think there were some other forces out there. One was the side that wanted it more had lost 8 years earlier in Florida and was trying to get back at that. And also the memory of Paul Wellstone was around this recount as well. Senator Coleman had beaten Wellstone in an election that people thought Wellstone would win. Franken's political inspiration was Paul Wellstone. So it wasn't just lawyering. There was a lot of stuff happening that drove this recount. And while This Is Not Florida, that's the name of the book, you know, is an inside, fly-on-the-wall look at the recount, with a particular emphasis really on how Franken's team perform, I think it does detail a template for how these future recounts will be conducted. I'm hoping, no matter what side they're on, that people will read it as they do their recounts in 2 weeks or in 2 years. That's all, though, within the context of a really wide range of election laws and procedures from state to state. So even though we here in Minnesota lived through our recount and thought it was tedious and complicated and had all these players and it lasted all these weeks, there are different recount laws in every state. And so as we get our crystal ball out and see where the recounts are going to happen, don't think that what occurred in Minnesota will be recreated elsewhere. For instance, Nevada is now a battleground. Harry Reid, challenger Sharron Engel, There's no mandatory recount there. No matter how close it is, the loser has to seek the recount, and he or she has got to decide to pay for it. And if they win, then the state comes in and pays for it. So there isn't, like ours, half of 1%, and it's instant. And no matter what the triggering method, the modern recount is a sort of campaign in overtime, in extra innings. And it operates on these levels of legal and technological, political, PR, again, fundraising, and even a certain amount of social networking. It seems like only yesterday that it was 2008, but the Twitter world was not really that robust in 2008. YouTube was, and you know, Franken's team used YouTube effectively to find and to use absentee ballot people who cast absentee ballots in order to show that their vote hadn't counted. It was a sympathetic YouTube video. Coleman's team actually used the web to help their voters see if their votes had been rejected or not. Fortunately, we now have a new system from the Secretary of State's office, so all of us can check that at a neutral site. But even back in 2008, technology was used, and you can be sure that any recount this year will have super-duper amounts of technology to find voters and for voters to see where they stand. So all of those elements that I just mentioned, I'd like to talk about each of those in describing how Franken won the Senate race by 312 votes out of about 2.9 million cast. And in that, I want to talk about some moments of truth for me, either during the recount period from November 2008 to July 2009, or in the back reporting that I did subsequent to Franken's swearing in. There were moments of truth when I realized that the Franken forces were generally on top of their game, and the Coleman side was frequently not. I spoke to about 40 players in the recount after Franken was sworn in. Of all the key players, everyone spoke to me except for Senator Coleman and Ben Ginsburg. So lawyers on both sides did, campaign managers on both sides did, political operatives on both sides did. And so I feel that I tried my best to be fair and balanced. But by the way, between November 2008 and July 2009, I was probably at just about every news conference. I missed two or three days of the canvassing board, which is this administrative board that they had, and I missed just one day of the trial, so I should get some battle pay of some sort. So let's start with the preparation and the motivation. It's back in the summer of 2008, and Franken's campaign is really going sideways a little bit for allegations of he didn't pay his taxes, which wasn't really totally true, the digging up of old drug and former drug use, and Senator Coleman's former drug use, and just a general kind of disarray it felt around his campaign. And he had not won the endorsement yet from the DFL, the Democratic Party here. Stephanie Shriok was brought in to be his campaign manager and right the ship, and she is not a secret person, because I write about her a lot, but a lot of people don't realize the impact that she had on this campaign, you know, to turn things around. And pretty much by then, by the summer of 2008, Mark Elias, who's an elections law expert in Washington, had been engaged by the Franken campaign, not necessarily for the recount, but he had certainly been Franken's lawyer. Elias is the lawyer for almost all the Democratic senators and all the candidates, and his law firm, Perkins Coie, which is based in Seattle but has a political arm in Washington, represented the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and Barack Obama. Elias's mentor, Bob Bauer, is now the White House counsel, and one of the young lawyers who worked on the recount, Kate Andreas, is now in the White House counsel's office, so these people are well connected. And by early October, Shriok had hired Dave Lillehog, the former U.S. attorney here in Minnesota, to nail down a really full-throated recount plan. That was done about October 12, October 15. So we had 3 full weeks, but we're not just talking about thinking about it, we're talking about a plan. And in the first hours of election night, and these are in the wee hours, there was a conference call when it became clear that there was going to be a recount. Kevin Hamilton, who is Seattle-based in the same law firm, he got on the phone and he told everybody, study absentee ballots, look at absentee ballots. People always screw up, particularly Democrats. They're really sloppy voters. And Kevin had worked on the Christine Gregoire Dino Rossi recount in 2004, where absentee ballots were an issue. The other thing about Hamilton is that from the moment he landed in Minneapolis, which would have been like the 11th of November, he was thinking about a trial. He's a trial attorney. And just keep that in mind when you realize that the Coleman legal team and its lead trial lawyer wasn't hired until about 3 days before the first scheduling meeting on that trial in January. And that was Joe Friedberg, who's a great lawyer here in town, well-known, nice man, but wouldn't have known an election law if he tripped over it in January, and suddenly he had to represent Senator Coleman against Kevin Hamilton, who had experience and who was planning for 2 months for this thing. Also on these calls was a man named Chris Sauter, who to me is an unknown person and someone I like, and he is arguably the most experienced and well-trained trainer of volunteers at recounts, and he's a recount technician. In the book, I call him the carny of recount people because he goes from state fair to state fair, recount to recount, and he doesn't operate the Ferris wheel, but he operates the recount. So that team was in place early on, and they brought about 30 recounts, 30 statewide recounts in their ammo. It remains unclear to me still exactly how closely Ben Ginsburg was involved in the recount early on. People tell me that he was on calls. I know that he came here to the Twin Cities soon afterwards, at least once. But in the early stages, it became clear that the Coleman side believed that local lawyers should do it for PR reasons and because they felt comfortable. And also, Senator Coleman felt that he was going to win. And I think that's, you know, one of the flaws that people who are going to face a recount next week or 2 weeks should deal with. If you're ahead, do not assume you're going to win. These things do flip. They don't flip often. Some people think maybe four or five times in the last 25 years have statewide recounts flipped in the United States. But it can happen, particularly with 215 votes. And neither Fritz Kanak or Tony Trimble, who were Senator Coleman's top lawyers, had ever been involved in a statewide recount. They'd done other recounts, but not statewide. Tony Trimble, again, a very nice fellow, a graduate of William Mitchell College of Law. I see Eric Janis here. He's the dean. And Tony is a Mitchell grad. He told me in this back reporting that to prepare for the Franken-Coleman recount, he dusted off, and those were the words he used, his files from the U.S. House recount of David Mingy and Mark Kennedy of 2000. That was a recount that drew very little attention and very little firepower from either of the political parties because it happened in 2000 and Florida was underway and the nation's eyes were there and all the big hitters, including Sauter and Ginsburg, were in Florida. It also did not have any of the machinery that our Senate-wide recount had, like a canvassing board, and there wasn't any issue of absentee ballots. It wasn't even as close, really, I don't think, as this Senate one. So you get the early picture. Not only was the Franken team staffed up and engaged, but there was the spirit, the bitter taste of Florida. There was a certain revenge. The Democrats wanted to come in here. He was the 60th seat. He was Al Franken. And the Wellstone spirit is hanging over that thing as Norm Coleman is kind of the symbol of that. So now let me move on to the phase of the technology and attention to detail that helped the Franken recount effort. And this is where Sauter comes in again. He's the recount veteran. And he literally wrote the book on it. It's called The Recount Primer, or Primer, depending on what part of your country you're from. He wrote it with some other guys. And it lays out for the Democrats, or for anyone who gets a hold of it, how you're supposed to do a recount. And Chris is very committed to this notion of the call at the table. And when I talk about the call at the table, I'm talking about regular votes. This is before absentee ballots come into it. These are the votes that go into the voting machines. And when we have a recount, a hand recount, the regular ballots are counted by hand, all 2.99 million of them. And if you recall, it was crazy. It started on November 19th, 110 locations, 87 counties, 4,130 precincts, nutty. So after election night, Coleman is ahead by about 700 or so. But when the dust settles and late precincts come in and math errors are corrected and the normal organic shaking out of votes occurs and happens in every election, we just don't know about it, he's up by 215 when the recount starts. And Elias, through Chris Sauter, through this carny of recounts, tells volunteers, and they have thousands of volunteers, to make sure you record the call at the table. Now, what do I mean by the call at the table? This is the back of the book, and I know you can't really see it, but these are ballots here. And on some ballots, like Franken is crossed off, but people will write in, I want him anyway. Or here, both Franken and Coleman are the ovals are filled, but he or she has no next to Norm Coleman. Then we've got the lizard people votes, and we've got, you know, Brett Favre and the Flying Spaghetti Monsters and all of those people. So when the votes are recounted, there are volunteers at the table, and they can challenge these votes about voter intent, saying, no, that doesn't look like it's for Coleman, it doesn't look like it's for Franken. Ultimately, all this voter intent stuff is determined by the state canvassing board down the road, and it would be in this case, too, two Supreme Court justices, two district court justices, the Secretary of State. But in the trenches, it's the two parties that challenge the ballots, local officials, average, hardworking, well-meaning people say, no, that I think the voter intent was for Coleman. No, I think it was for Franken. And the Franken side had this theory, based on Sauter's experience, that the call at the tables by experienced election officials are generally correct. There's no reason to disbelieve that when Mrs. Jones or Mr. Smith says, no, I'm sorry, that intent was for Coleman, that they're making it up or they're cheating or anything. They're just good, honest, hardworking Minnesota officials. So it's kind of like the NFL. This is what Mark Elias says and this is what I say. You need indisputable evidence to overturn a challenge. And in most cases, just keep track of what's going on at the table. So with that in mind, the Franken team set up these virtual offices, really, that went out to every counting place, 106 sites. And they employed what they called a Pony Express to get all their data back to headquarters in St. Paul as quickly as possible. Early on, the lawyers from out of town said, well, why don't we just get all the ballots, scan them in, turn them to PDFs, send them over the broadband from Worthington or Duluth, and we'll do it. And Alana Peterson, who's actually in Franken's office now, said, hey, guys, there's no broadband in Beltrami County, or we can't just shoot up, 2.9 million votes just like that. Thus, the Pony Express came about. And I won't read it, but there was a guy in the Franken campaign named Dusty Trice, and he was enlisted to assemble these 106 self-contained mini offices in white cardboard banker's boxes. Each set of boxes had a rented laptop, a cell modem, two cell phones, dozens of pens, two staplers, five clipboards, each of them with template sheets that Chris Sauter had devised so volunteers could record every move and every vote. Some of the supplies were hanging around from the just-completed campaign, but Trice told me we went to 15 office maxes and bought every single clipboard in the Twin Cities. And Trice's team assembled more than 300 boxes, each weighed 20 pounds. They filled three 12-by-12-foot offices. It rose 6 feet high. They were placed in trucks, which were rented, and they were distributed in these voting places or these counting places. And Sauter said he had never seen a recount that well done. And he told that to Franken, and Franken, whenever he made fundraising calls, told Steven Spielberg and Barbara Streisand and all those people were really well organized. So that was the foundation of finding out where they stood on day-to-day. And the importance of that is really, as they say, if you don't know where you stand, you know where you're going. And if you didn't know that you were kind of catching up a little bit, you might have other strategies. They were already working on a side strategy of the absentee ballots anyway. But the Coleman team was not as exacting. And their people told me that. Early on, they sort of didn't keep track of the call at the table. Some other people weren't told to keep track of the call at the table. They had a feel, but they didn't have an exact idea. And in the book, you'll see that different key players thought they were ahead, they were behind, he didn't know. The campaign manager and the two lawyers had three different views as to where they stood. Then all these ballots would return to St. Paul on the Dusty Trice Pony Express, and that's when they would be PDF'd, and they would be tagged by technological people, and you would know if those were votes that were crossed off or weren't crossed off or said lizard people or didn't. So when the canvassing board came about, the Franken team could keep a consistent notion of what votes were being challenged and accepted. And if the canvassing board would forget or not be consistent, they could point it out. In the end, Chief Justice Magnuson, Eric Magnuson, kept his own cheat sheet, and he did a good job on his own. What they were finding, though, is that when you're behind by 215 and there's 2.9 million votes, it's not that hard for a thing to swing. If you think about it, it's 2.5 votes a county, really. It really isn't that hard. And votes do come about. Now, of course, Senator Coleman will find votes, too. Early on, they both lost votes because there was overcounting, or Dean Barkley, the third candidate, had gotten more than they thought. But the irony is that this attention to detail really got the Franken people crazy, because the Secretary of State and the news media was not keeping track of it in the same way. And what the Secretary of State's office was doing, and we in the news media were picking up, was the challenged ballots, not the counted ballots. And if you take the challenged ballots out of the count, you don't really know where the count stands. And if the Coleman team is challenging more ballots than the Franken team, it might mean that Franken is picking up less votes. In the end, they both challenged too many and it got out of hand. In any event, there was a discrepancy between what the Franken team began to feel they knew and what was being reported out in the news media, which led to a story in the Star Tribune, my former employer, in the last weekend of November, that said, with a big honking chart that seemed to be official, that Franken couldn't win. It was impossible for him to win. It was, and this chart, you know those charts you have on a map that says how far you are from Indianapolis or Kansas City, and you got to try to read it? That's the way that chart was. I couldn't figure it out. Well, the problem was that there were these dueling news conferences between Mark Elias of the Coleman of the Franken team and Fritz Canuck of the Coleman team, and they were trying to score points in Washington and try to do fundraising. And Mark had great connections to the Washington bloggers. Fritz did not. And the other problem was the Obama administration was forming. There was a lot of excitement. The economy was really in the tank. Rich people had already given their money to these candidates. There was a lot of campaign fatigue. Franken was on the phone for 6 hours a day trying to raise money. That was his full-time job. And now the state's largest newspaper was saying he can't win. So the Franken people went bonkers because they just thought, well, nobody's going to give us money if we're going to lose. And they were getting calls from the big hitters in Washington like Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid saying, hey, we should just pull the plug here, guys. Well, this forced Elias to begin revealing what he wanted to keep close to the vest, that is, that they were catching up. He really didn't want to tell people that quite yet. And this then created one of the most memorable moments for me of the recount. And it was a snowy Saturday. We're now late into the recount. It's December, and the canvassing board has already begun to meet, and the absentee ballot issue has really started to get heated up. And it was like one of those Mary Tyler Moore opening shows where it's just snowing and snowing and it's going sideways and the windows are all frosted. And there are only two of us, only two reporters showed up. Rachel Stassenberger, who was then with the Pioneer Press, and I were there. We both lived near the headquarters. And Elias and Andy Barr, who's then the news press secretary, were really, really just proud as could be that they were having a news conference on Saturday during a blizzard, 4 days before, 5 days before Christmas. I don't know why they felt that way. And Elias, who is just a great, funny character of a guy who jingles change in his pocket and his knee is always moving and he's just a superstitious big guy who moves his arms around like this all the time. And he had been saying for the last couple weeks, we're ahead by two, we're down by four, we're up by 24, and we all just kind of, you know, said, this guy is nutty. He said, Al Franken will have more votes than Norm Coleman when the canvassing board meets next week. We believe firmly that margin will be between 35 and 50. At some point not long after that, Al Franken will stand before you as the senator-elect from Minnesota. So he declared that on December 20. And I'm sure that Rachel and I just kind of shook our heads. And there was a conference call, but I don't think anybody was on the conference call. I didn't even know if the Star Tribune covered that. And he was so filled with, you know, confidence. He was just smug about it. And you know, this was the culmination of the Shriock hiring early on, of Chris Sauter's rules, of the technology being done, of the Pony Express. They now felt that they were ahead by 35 to 50. Well, 3 days later, the canvassing board met, and he was up by 46. And then a couple more cleaning house happened, he was up by 49. And Elias joked then that he was glad that it wasn't 51 because people wouldn't have trusted his numbers. But for me, it was a real moment of truth of, I think I should listen to Mark Elias because he might be right. And the Coleman team said, we don't know where these numbers are coming from. And that was another revelation really to the Franken side that the Coleman team really didn't know where these numbers were coming from. And that gave them a boost. And then the absentee ballot issue heated up. And I think we saw another key moment, at least for me as a Minnesotan, and really one of the big surprises of the recount for both sides. And it had to do with fairness. There were two guys who I think, two men who stood for that during this recount. And one was Chief Justice Eric Magnuson. The other was Mark Ritchie, the Secretary of State. And I don't say this because I like either of them or know either of them or care about either of them. I just think they did the right thing. Magnuson had been appointed by Tim Pawlenty. He was Pawlenty's friend, supposedly, and a law partner, Republican Chief Justice. And in the end, he sided with Franken's effort to get the wrongly rejected absentee ballots in the count. It was something that turned the Republicans in the state absolutely livid because they thought that Eric Magnuson would side with them. In fact, the outside lawyers from both teams thought this would be just like the East Coast or the West Coast, that the Minnesota courts, because they're appointed by Tim Pawlenty, would be Republican, that Mark Ritchie, because he was arguably the most left-wing elected official in the state, would be for the Democrats, and then they would slug that out, that Lori Swanson, who's the attorney general, would be this way or that way. It didn't turn out that way at all, really. And in fact, the Democrats started disliking Mark Ritchie because they thought he was bending over backwards for the Republicans, and the Republicans were looking at Eric Magnuson saying, what are you doing? You're letting this guy have more votes. We need to shut this baby down. And in the end, you know, there's talk now since Ritchie is running for Secretary of State that he sort of swung the election somehow. They looked at the canvassing board, and that's this administrative board that's before the trial. They looked at 1,500 challenge ballots, and the board split 3-2 on 14 of the 1,500. And Ritchie sided with the left-leaning judges 7 times and with the right-leaning judges 7 times. And Mark Ritchie says in the book and told me, whatever G. Barry Anderson, who's the Republican Supreme Court Justice, voted because he was keeping track of the votes. He just said, whatever he says is fine with me. So they agreed 96% of the time, these 5 people who are very different, appointed by different people or elected. In some ways, I think one of the bigger surprises for Minnesotans is that these people just kind of did the straight and narrow. Let me tell you about another surprise that I'm pretty sure wasn't written about before the book, and that is the role of the Obama campaign in the Franken campaign. And the role was they didn't have any, and that is one reason why people think, you know, Franken lost that first time around, or that Franken didn't get the margin that he should have. He certainly lost from the amount of votes that Barack Obama did by 12 percentage points. Obama wins the state by 54% and Franken by 42%, and that is a huge, huge gap. You know, maybe it was Franken's baggage that he brought in, and maybe it was Obama's understanding that he was going to win the state. But he got that 54% and Franken got 42%, and people who know say that if Obama would have spent an hour at the Twin Cities Airport on the Sunday or Monday before the election, or gone to Duluth in particular for an hour, they sent Hillary Clinton there instead on the Monday before the election, that would have created 2,000 votes. It probably would have created 2,000 votes, and we probably wouldn't be here today. That's really all you needed. But it didn't happen. In fact, Jeff Blodgett, who is a campaign professional, was Paul Wellstone's campaign manager, was Obama's state campaign manager, and he was really, really disturbed that they didn't allow any literature that had Franken and Obama on the same piece of paper. So Jeff went a little rogue at the end and created one of those door-hanging signs that you get in the last couple of days of the election, and it had both faces on that, and the Chicago people never saw it. But it was really, it hurt. And turnout was less because there was an anticipation that Obama was going to win. We still had the highest turnout in the country of 78%, but Jeff was seeking 80%. And again, those 2 percentage points, probably up in the range, and the eighth congressional district would have made the difference. However, you know, Obama's impact was felt, and that was through the absentee ballots. There was a tremendous absentee ballot effort on the part of the Obama campaign led by Jeff Blodgett, and we did have, you know, the largest absentee ballot numbers in history, 293,000 absentee ballots, so about 10% of our voting was that. And that created all the kerfuffle of what's a good absentee ballot and what isn't. If people have questions about how things have changed this election, I can answer them afterwards. But things have changed for the better to undo some of the mistakes and some of the controversies of 2008. But I want to fast forward, and I want to fast forward to the trial because it took so much time, even though I think in the end it wasn't all that important because Franken had already won at the canvassing board. And the trial was really an effort by Senator Coleman to catch up. He was playing offense, but in the end, if you recall, he started the trial up by 225, but he ended the trial, Coleman starts the trial behind by 225. When it's over, he's behind by 312. So this trial that was his idea winds up costing him 87 votes because of Franken's effort, you know, to get votes. And again, Franken's team, I think, was more prepared, more data-centric. They had kept track of absentee ballot voters. And of course, there's a lot at stake. He was going to be now the 60th senator. It would be filibuster-proof. The health care matter was coming up, as were other things, and there was a lot at stake for, you know, for both sides. And this leads to the most dramatic to me and eerie and touching exchange of the whole recount. But it also shows the extent to which the Franken side was willing to go to get a vote. And it involves Kevin Hamilton, who is his lawyer from Seattle, examining Joe Mansky, who's the election official from Ramsey County. And I think I might read some of this, if people don't mind, because it does, it's like a Perry Mason kind of Law and Order type thing. Exhibit F-2232 lived in a category by itself. The exhibit was the absentee ballot of Donald P. Simmons, cast on October 29, 6 days before the election. In as polite but lawyerly a way as he could, Hamilton performed a noticeably monotone direct examination of Mansky. Exactly why the exchange was so sober was soon evident. "Mr. Simmons properly completed the absentee ballot application form, yes?" Hamilton asked. "Yes," Mansky said. "And properly completed the absentee ballot outside envelope? The signatures match? The addresses match?" "Yes," said Mansky. "Now, Mr. Simmons, he was a properly registered voter at the time that he cast the ballot, was he not?" Hamilton asked. Mansky paused. He looked at his documents. Hamilton repeated, "Do you know if he was a properly registered voter?" Mansky took his time. He said, "I don't know that. The reason I say that is I looked up the voter record here. He has deceased status. What we don't know is, since this was printed out recently, if he was eligible on Election Day." So they didn't know if Donald Simmons was alive or not on Election Day. "What do we need to figure out?" Hamilton asked Mansky. "And what they need to figure out is that as long as you're alive, at some point on Election Day, your ballot should count." This is not Chicago, okay? You don't really. And Mansky says, "Yes, that's what we need to figure out." And Hamilton repeats, "So we need to figure out is the time or the date of his death." "Yes." So that exchange is over. Hamilton moves on to the next exhibit. But members of the Franken staff are watching the trial on the uptake, the C-SPAN I call it the psychedelic C-SPAN in the book, but it's a, you know, this computerized TV channel here. And they quickly run over to from DFL headquarters to Department of Health in St. Paul, look for Donald Simmons' death certificate, and lunchtime, we're back in court. Mansky's back on the stand, and Hamilton offers Exhibit F-3007 into evidence, and it's Simmons' just-acquired death certificate. And Hamilton shows it to Mansky. "Let me step back. Donald Simmons was 65. He was an African-American guy. He had liver cancer. He came to Minnesota to get a transplant. His children were here. He really wanted to vote for Obama. He loved jazz. His wife is a very nice person. They moved from Springfield, Massachusetts to be near their kids. The Franken team in their absentee ballot hunt had found his name, sent a subpoena to him, and Mrs. Simmons called back and said, you know, he's dead. They still pursued it, the Franken team did. Mr. Mansky, Hamilton says, is this the same individual who we were discussing before the break? That is correct, Mansky says. Can you read the name and date of death of this voter? The person's name is Donald Peter Simmons. The date of death was November 27th, 2008, Mansky said. So he was alive on Election Day, Hamilton says. His vote should count. And Mansky says, yes. And then 3 weeks later, when the judges did count all the absentee ballots, Donald Simmons' vote was counted. He was one of the 312. So it's pretty, that's what organization is and determination. You know, most of you know I'm not really a political pundit, but I'm kind of a recovering sports writer, and I stumbled into the story. I had no idea about elections or recounts, but like sports, there are personalities in politics, and that was sort of why I felt it felt like I was back in the sports world, really. There, a lot of guys, that's for sure. And there were errors. There are a lot of errors, and there were, you know, big plays. The Hamilton Simmons moment was, you know, a big play, and there were major offensive and defensive errors. There were counts at the table, but this really wasn't a game, you know, and this was not for a trophy. And for Minnesota, it was really about statewide identity, I think, because we are a state that worries about how people think about us and how we do, and we have this inferiority complex, of how we're doing compared to the rest of the world, which leads to the title, which is called This Is Not Florida. And it grew from an exchange between Roger Magnuson and Supreme Court Justice Paul Anderson. And the New Yorker also said, we have a lot of Andersons here in Minnesota. We do. There are two major Magnusons and two major Andersons in this book, and it drove me crazy, too. Anyway, Magnuson is a very respected lawyer here in town, bow-tied kind of guy, and politics conservative. I'd actually met him when he represented the Twins when they tried to get out of their lease at the Dome in the 1990s, so I knew him in that realm as well. And he had been one of George Bush's lawyers in Florida before the Florida Senate, and he had actually won the Bush case before the Florida Senate that spun into the area where the U.S. Supreme Court could shut the recount down. And Roger kind of swaggered up to the lectern before the Minnesota State Supreme Court on an issue of whether to stop the absentee ballots from being counted or not. That was the basic issue. And that's what he wanted and what Senator Coleman wanted to have done in late December. And you could feel the judges kind of move up in their seats because he's respected, and they thought, this is going to be a pretty good show here. And he said, may it please the court, on December 12th, the state canvassing board, with the best of intentions, accepted an invitation, we believe, to go to Florida. And as tempting as that invitation is, given the weather outside the courtroom today, and then he was interrupted by Paul Anderson. And Justice Anderson had promised himself that he wouldn't ask any questions for about 5 minutes. If you know Justice Anderson, that's very hard for him to do. And it took him about 37 seconds. And he was really mad. And he said, counsel, I know you've been to Florida. This is not Florida. And I'm just not terribly receptive to you telling us we're going to Florida and we're comparing to that. This is Minnesota. We've got a case in Minnesota. Argue the case in Minnesota. That really set the tone for the rest of the recount. This was only the late December, and it established the fact that we were going to do it, you know, on our own. So I think any candidate who faces a recount this election cycle should think about preparation, should think about data, should think about that rapid response, should think about the idiosyncrasies of the state that he or she is in. And if you add it all up, it might lead to victory. But you do need the votes, and they're there or they're not. So thanks for coming and questions. Any questions? Yes, go ahead.
I got a question. I understand why Franken won the recount. But I'm kind of curious why you think he won the election, because you mentioned two things. Rumors of drug use, mm-hmm. not paying taxes, which was true, mm-hmm. His sexist writings, mm-hmm. which ultimately led Amy Klobuchar Penny McCollum,
yep.
not to endorse him, mm-hmm. and Betty held off for quite a long time, mm-hmm. and then the charges of carpetbagging, that he had not lived in Minnesota in 30 years, he came back here, mm-hmm. established residency, no elected office experience, but yet he was able to beat someone who, by all means, had been a pretty good senator, been a very good mayor of St. Paul. Mm-hmm. Was it because he was identified with Bush? Is that why you think he? Because those are some pretty big garbage he had to overcome there.
Sure. Well, first of all, it was 42-42-16, so it was close. Secondly, the recount is the election, and so if you win the recount, you have won the election. It's the shaking out of the votes. There's no doubt that I think I write in chapter 5 here, you know, that Franken was a tough candidate and a Democrat in 2008 against a Bush-aligned Republican senator who had voted for the bailout. And if you remember, the polls changed dramatically when Coleman voted for the bailout, the bank bailout. It changed from Coleman being ahead to Franken being ahead. I think it was October 15th. That hurt Coleman, even though in retrospect some people think it might have been the right vote. And the other thing that really shook out the campaign that no one can figure out was the final weekend when there were the allegations about Senator Coleman's wife getting money from an insurance company, and then Coleman having a last-minute commercial blaming Franken for that, and then Franken having an unprecedented Sunday night TV commercial before the Tuesday saying, it wasn't me, get out of here, Norm Coleman is lying to you. So I think to answer your question, I think he won the election. And the recount. I think that you're right. It was super close, and I think that this the Obama turnout, even though it wasn't as good as it should have been, helped Rankin a lot too. So I don't know if that answers it, but you know, I think that the fact that Coleman as an incumbent can only get 42% doesn't say a lot about his strength either. Barkley got 16%, which is what's the difference?
I think Ron is something, because in the campaign they constantly identified Coleman with Bush. Mm-hmm. And now what's happening across the country in a lot of these elections, they are identifying Obama with the particular candidate that's running. And matter of fact, a lot of these candidates said they don't want anything to do with Obama. Right. They don't want him campaigning for him or anything. So is the president has that much influence?
Ask Harry Reid. Yeah. You know, I think so.
Whatever became, or what is the story about those phantom votes that were in somebody's trunk in Minneapolis and then ended up in a warehouse? Were they ever real?
The so-called 32 in the trunk of Cindy Reichert, they weren't, and I write about that here. They were votes, and let me recall, since I've written this a while ago, but they were votes that were discovered in a precinct. They were totally under control in the right custody. Cindy Reichert, or somewhat, she used to be the Hennepin County election official or Minneapolis election official, calls the Coleman offices on the Friday night after the election and says, we want to count these on Saturday, because the canvas, the actual counting by each election unit, has to be done quickly. The Coleman people get suspicious. They seek a hearing the next morning before Judge Kathleen Geeran, who winds up being on the canvassing board. And in the end, Fritz Knock tells me that they never said it was in the trunk. Knock didn't say it was in the trunk. It was some bloggers who afterwards said it had been in the trunk. And then Tim Pawlenty went on Fox News and said it was in a trunk about 3 or 4 days after David Brower of MinnPost had said it wasn't true. So those ballots, that was not true. And the Rankin people call that, I think, the Saturday morning ambush. I forget what it's called, the sneak attack. But it really got, it hurt the Coleman side, because it got the Rankin team to realize these guys are going to be on their toes going after us at any moment. And it really was a wake-up call to the Rankin team that the Coleman side was going to be aggressive on that score. Yes.
What do you think the chances that Senator Rankin will appear with Obama here this weekend?
I would think that he would. But, he doesn't return my calls. Neither of them. What do you think? Yeah.
I'll be at the football game.
Yeah. I think that he will.
At some point, it became fairly clear that Rankin was going to win, possibly even as early as the canvassing board decision. Mm-hmm. Although you didn't get to speak with Senator Coleman, or former Senator Coleman, and Mr. Ginsburg, what do you think were the motivations that caused them to drag it out for another 6 months? And a second question, do you intend to market your book in Florida?
I've gotten some calls from people from news organizations in Florida, so sure, that'd be great. I prefer it here, but that'd be fine. The first question was, I'm sorry. Oh, well, yes, I do think that they dragged it out so that Rankin wouldn't get seated, but I also believe they had the right to do it, and I don't begrudge Norm Coleman that at all. Much of the delay had nothing to do with what he did. I mean, on January 6th, he appeals the canvassing board effort and for the election contest. He was entitled to do that. Our laws do make it really quick. In 20 days, we had a trial. It wasn't his fault the trial lasted 7 weeks. The judges, who are all good people, and I've gotten to know a couple of them, gave him as much time as he wanted. And they acknowledged for the first couple weeks, they were catching up on what this was all about. Mark Elias said something like, in Virginia, they give you 2 weeks for capital punishment cases. In Minnesota, you get 7 weeks for a recount that a guy already won. Right?
In the book, do you write about what Al was doing during the recount? Because I always thought the person who had the toughest job was whoever had to roll him up in a rug, so he didn't say anything during the recount.
I don't write much about it, only other than he was fundraising. It was a decided political and public relations move to have him out of the picture. And some of us thought that Senator Coleman being in the courtroom often was a bad idea because it really showed, it seemed to indicate that he didn't have anything to do. You know, and after a while when he was there often, there was a certain pathos to that. And then he was there when some arguments were going on in which his side was just getting hammered by, for instance, the Supreme Court and the final arguments. So, the message from the Franken side was he's preparing to be a senator. He's in Washington. Of course, the Star Tribune found him on vacation early on. But I think that in the end, the thing that Al Franken did during this recount was delegate and follow instructions, and he did the right thing. He delegated to Stephanie Shriok, and she was his surrogate client. She was the client, and Mark Elias reported to her, and they briefed Franken every night, either by phone or in person, and he had them over the house a lot. But if you remember, he was only when the trial started, he made some appearances where he met with mayors and that sort of stuff to show that he was still around. But I don't think that they really had to roll him up in a carpet. I think he was chomping at the bit to go to Washington. You know, I know that, but I don't think he had much. I don't think he had much. He wasn't available to us at all. And the one long interview that I had with him came in January when they were trying to establish the fact that he was going to be kind of senatorial. Yes.
You commented on the ballots that were found in a trunk or allegedly lost in a trunk. There's another set of ballots from the city of Minneapolis that were never located.
Right, 132 of those.
Have you been able to find them?
I have them in my trunk. I wasn't asked to find them, but the judges ruled that they were valid votes. And this is the sort of, if you were a recount junkie, this is the famous, there were five envelopes, one of two, one of five, two of five, three of five, four of five, five of five, and the number one is missing. So there's a theory that, well, you wouldn't count them, two, three, four, and five, without a one. And this is where David Lillehaug has his, you know, kind of TV moment, and he shows how Tyvek envelopes can be slippery, and it's possible that someone had five of them and one of them slipped away. The 132 votes were counted that night, judges ruled, as did the recount rules, say that if they had been counted on that night and there was prima facie evidence that they existed, then they should count. So, no, the 132 haven't been found, and I believe there were 70 in Roseville, as I recall, that also went missing. And those 132 were important to Frank, and I think he had a net of about 46. They were at the university, and that. Early on, after that Saturday morning sneak attack, was also the issue of the Coleman team accusing Franken of wanting to raid the church because it was at the University Church, Lutheran Church of Hope on campus. And Franken and Elias said, "We need to go everywhere. We need to dig into the basement." And it became a big kind of kerfuffle. No, those ballots weren't found, but they were counted. Yes.
Was there any provision so that if the recount had instead passed the term that Coleman had, if it gone into January, what would have happened? Could Pawlenty have appointed somebody?
It did happen on the day that they counted the first round of absentee ballots on January 3rd. Norm Coleman's term expired, and then our seat was vacant. And there are some states in which you could have attempted to be seated, and the Senate seats the senators. And so Mark Elias attempted to get Al Franken there, and it's possible that a Supreme Court somewhere could have said, yes, he can be seated, and we'll let the U.S. Senate seat them. Our Supreme Court didn't allow that. They waited many weeks to say no to that. And so we didn't have a senator from January 3rd until July 7th.
The governor can't appoint somebody during that
period. Not under those circumstances. And this leads to the question of whether we should have some sort of provisional seating here in Minnesota. In Louisiana, they did, and that caused a major controversy with Mary Landrieu maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, as I recall. And that I believe that we should. You know, that I think that if it looks like he's won the recount and the canvassing board has certified that he's gotten the most votes, I don't see why not. And then if the Coleman contest would have overturned it, then Norm Coleman, you know, would get the seat. But we were with just one senator for, 6 months.
Do you have any thought as to why Norm Coleman did not appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm not a lawyer either, but the people who read the opinion, the state Supreme Court's opinion, said the one person, the William Mitchell law professor does election stuff, said it was unassailable, that the opinion that the Minnesota Supreme Court wrote was so tightly written that it was hard. Both the trial court and the Supreme Court both acknowledged that there were no equal protection issues in this recount, like Bush v. Gore. And so there really weren't any federal issues that seemed to rise to it. And I think at that point, you know, I write in the book that they sort of knew what was coming because of the way the Supreme Court argument went. And when Coleman opened his laptop and read it himself at his home, he just said, that's it, I'm done. Some other people on the phone were trying to say, I see a sentence here, I see there's an opening there. And he said, come on, guys, you know, there isn't any need to do it. So there just wasn't an issue there to, you know, to bring. Hi, Lori.
I'm sorry I'm late, but and you maybe have already addressed this, but I'm interested in your take on the performance of Secretary of State Mark Ritchie, who is now being accused in this election year by his opponent of being party to a variety of fraudulent or errors by both omission and commission during this process. Tell us what you think about how he conducted himself during this whole recount.
Well, I like Lori a lot, but I did talk about that. and really what I said was that he was in my view so fair that it was the Democrats who were more angry with him than were the Republicans. They thought that Ritchie bent over backwards to be fair. And in the challenge ballots, there were about 1,500 that were counted. There was a 96% percentage rate of agreement across the board of the five canvassing board members, and there were only 14-3-2 votes on the board, and Ritchie voted 7 times with Anderson and Magnuson and 7 times with Guerin and Cleary. So I don't think that there was any way that he could have been any fairer, really, and there's no indication that he sided with Franken at all, even though he did appear with Al Franken in some campaign appearances before the election. I've heard people say that the election was stolen. But it was stolen, you know, in plain view with 12 judges, half of them appointed by Republicans. And so I think Mark Ritchie did a fine job. And again, I don't know him. I've never had dinner with him. But, you know, I just watched him, and he seemed to do. And I was just in Seattle and met the elections officials there. And Ritchie is respected around the country for his, attempts to be more modern and to change the system. And a lot of the things that we've changed in our system here on absentee ballots since 2008 were something that Ritchie wanted beforehand, but Tim Pawlenty vetoed some of those. So it's not an endorsement or anything, but I think did a fair job. Well, thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks very much.